Hello. Welcome to Midwave Radio. I'm Dheeraj Devarajan, and you are listening to The Rundown. This is your weekly sports show right here at Midwave Radio at UChicago's radio station. And there has been a lot of action in the last week. A lot of action. There's a lot to talk about, and I can't wait to get into it. And it's just a really exciting time for sports. Obviously, we're in the off season for the NFL right now, so there are no games going on. And I think everyone who's listened to the show knows how much I love the NFL. So every time there's a trade rumor, every time there's a trade, every time there's a free agent signing, free agency starting soon in like a couple of weeks. I can't wait for that. Can't wait to see who the Packers sign. I have no clue. We don't have much cap space, but that's okay. I can't wait to see who all the teams sign. It's going to be really, really interesting. And the NBA is also on a roll. So this is like a perfect time for sport. Spring training's happening for baseball. I mean, everything's just starting up again, and it's going to be really, really, really exciting over the next few weeks to see how things play out. Once again, this is the Rundown. I'm Dheeraj Devarajan. Let's get started. So, what am I going to be talking about today? So, first of all, obviously, massive free agency signing. JJ Watt gets signed by the Arizona Cardinals. 2-year, $31 million deal. With $23 million guaranteed. Everyone thought he was going to go to a team that has immediate championship aspirations and basically ring hunt at a discounted price. And well, he didn't do that. He got his money. He went to a good team, and I'll get into that a bit later. I want to talk for a bit about some very interesting free agent quarterbacks. Who I think could definitely fill a role in certain teams, even though they might be undervalued by the market at certain points of time, as well as by the previous teams. I think some of these quarterbacks have been really underrated. And I want to talk about some non-free agent quarterbacks as well, some quarterbacks who are on teams. And I want to talk about the underrated ones, because I feel some quarterbacks aren't evaluated and rated as well as they should be. And I don't think they're rated fairly. And I think it's only right for someone to point out how good these quarterbacks actually are. And I'll move into the NBA. I want to talk about the Ball brothers for a bit because they're both on an absolute roll. Lonzo and LaMelo, I mean, LiAngelo is obviously not in the league right now, but Lonzo and LaMelo are on a roll. They've been playing great. I want to talk about them for a bit. I want to talk about Zion, the All-Star selections. What's happening with the Minnesota Timberwolves, by the way? I actually talked about that for a bit on one of my friends' podcasts. Go check out Arjun's podcast. He's a student here at the University of Chicago as well. It's called Turnaround Tuesdays. I believe it's on Apple Podcasts. Go check it out there. So there's a lot to talk about, and let's get started. Let's get started with the NBA. So, there's been a lot of players who have been hyped while coming into the NBA. You look back, there's even in like the late 60s, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was hyped as the greatest player to ever come out of college and high school. And he lived up to his expectation. I mean, the guy's probably the third greatest basketball player of all time behind LeBron and Jordan, in whatever order you want to put them to. Then you move forward, you think about Hakeem Olajuwon, you think about Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. There have been a lot of players that have fulfilled their kind of the hype that they had been built up to. But there have been some players who have not quite done it. Let's just put it that way to be kind. Michael Olowokandi, Elton Brand, Kwame Brown, Andrew Wiggins so far. Anthony Bennett's probably the biggest bust of all time. Greg Oden. A lot of players who haven't really lived up to the potential that they showed in college. And one of these players who was so hyped up coming in to the NBA was Lonzo Ball. I remember when he was drafted in 2017. Obviously, you see all these antics with his dad, Big Baller Brand, all these things. There's a lot of controversy surrounding the company. Look, I really like LeVar. I think he's always done what's best for his kids. So I have nothing to criticize him for. I mean, he's been a great dad. He's always pushed his kids forward, given them the best opportunity to succeed. And, this was kind of the beginning of when, LeVar and Lonzo and LaMelo, their whole family came into kind of public view with the Facebook show, with the brand, with traveling around, with playing in different countries, with having their own league, with sending LaMelo and LiAngelo to Lithuania, whatever it is. This is when they came into prominence. And Lonzo Ball was seen as this generational prospect at point guard. came out of UCLA. I think he averaged something like, I'm pretty sure he averaged a double double, close to triple double. He was just spectacular. He got outplayed by De'Aaron Fox in the NC in March Madness. I believe it was either the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight. I'm not sure which one, but he was outplayed by De'Aaron Fox over there. And then he was drafted number two by the Lakers. The number pick was obviously the Celtics. They traded down, traded with the 76ers. The Sixers took Markel with the number one pick, obviously to pair him with Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, the team that they had at the time. With the number two pick, Lonzo, the Lakers took Lonzo. The number three pick, Jason Tatum. I mean, I love that trade so much. Every single day, I thank God for that trade. And then, you know, that was really a quite that was quite a remarkable draft. You know, a lot of marquee players came out of that class: De'Aaron Fox, Donovan Mitchell, Kyle Kuzma. Just a lot of elite, really, really good players. Even if they're not elite, some really, really, really good players came out of the draft. But Lonzo Ball was touted as the generational player that was going to come out of the draft. And I believed in him. I believed in his passing ability. His passing ability was uncanny. It really did look like he was the second coming of Jason Kidd. Obviously, he had a quirky short form back then. His free throw shooting wasn't great, but he was a good field goal shooter. He was a good 3-point shooter. He was a great passer, a really good defender. He had size, speed, everything that you want from an NBA point guard. But the one thing he lacked, or seemed to lack, was aggression. And that showed in his first couple of seasons with the Lakers. You'd see him kind of almost be too passive at several points in time without actually being aggressive, going hell for leather. I remember, I think I was listening to ESPN one time, and one of the analysts said, you know, most rookies, most young players have a problem of going too hard. Lonzo Ball's the exact opposite. He's always in cruise control. I think it was Stephen A. Smith who said this, and I think he was completely right at that point in time. You know, Lonzo just used to coast. He would play the game at his own pace, and instead of bringing the entire game to his pace, which is what he was able to do in university, just when he was playing in university for UCLA, he was one and done. Just played 1 year in college, came out, and he was phenomenal that year, as I said before. What he did was, you know, he controlled the tempo essentially. But while he tried to do that in the NBA as well, but it just didn't work out for the first couple of seasons, because you can't be passive in the NBA. He was still a great defender, but in terms of the offensive play, kind of his shot got exposed. Like, he was shooting like 55% from the line or something, 30, 25, like 30% from three, not great from the field either. He was being exposed in terms of, you know, his quirky shooting form, things like that. And people really questioned whether he was a bust. And then, you know, he gets traded to the Pelicans for Anthony Davis, as a part of that package with Brandon Ingram. And, you know, that first year with LeBron, that the Lakers played with LeBron, there were a lot of good young pieces. I mean, you think about Brandon Ingram, Josh Hart, Lonzo Ball, all of these players really. They lost all of these players to the Pelicans as a part of that trade. But then an interesting thing happened. The Pelicans took Zion with the number one pick. And he changed his shooting form. He decided to make it more conventional. Brought the ball out from the right, from the right of his head, as opposed to the left of his head, which essentially makes it more difficult for the defender to predict when he's going to shoot, when he's going to pull up from mid-range. And you look at a shot now, it's such a quick draw, and it's quite accurate as well. He's shooting 40% from three, 44, 45% from the field, 75% from the line this year. He's been excellent this year, in terms of shooting. And you look at his assist stats over the last couple of years, they have dwindled a bit. I think he's averaging something like 5.5 assists or something now, as opposed to 7, 6.5 in his first couple of years. But you look at his overall play, and his defensive play has always been stellar. He's been playing really well. This season, at the beginning of the season, he struggled a bit on both sides of the ball. Again, that problem of aggression existed even when he was paired with Zion Williamson in that pick and roll situation. I mean, just a perfect pick and roll partner. Lonzo, his passing precision is almost unmatched in the NBA. He's one of the best passers in the NBA for sure. And his passing was lights out in pick and roll situations with Zion last season. But again, when the Pelicans went into the bubble, again, Lonzo seemed to have lost his shooting touch. He seemed to have lost that aggression. that we saw at some point in the regular season. And then he comes back this season. He doesn't get the contract extension that he wanted. He decides to play through the final year of his rookie contract and essentially put his money where his mouth is, and put his money on the line essentially by risking injury without a long-term contract, and because the Pelicans and Lonzo couldn't reach an agreement. And I think at this point in time, I think the Pelicans would be really, really, really dumb not to extend Lonzo, because the way Lonzo's been playing after having a bad start of the season, he's I think averaged like 10 points or something for the first 10 to 15 games, and now he's averaging 15 and a half, 6 and 5, with a steal and a half, and just playing excellent defense overall. The guy's been superb. He's been excellent. He's really punching above the weight that we thought he had. I've always believed in him, and I always wanted him to kind of show this kind of aggressive mentality that I knew he possessed, and that I knew would really propel him to become one of the really good players on his team as well as in the NBA. He's an above average NBA player right now. He's a good NBA player right now, and I think he has the potential to elevate even more. You look at yesterday's game, he was simply superb, shooting from the 3-point line, driving and playing in the pick and roll, ball handling, passing, shooting from the free throw line. I think he had 23, 8, and 7 yesterday against the best team in the league, the Utah Jazz. And, I couldn't be happy for Lonzo Ball. I think he's an excellent player. He's an excellent dude. Really quiet. Seems like a really nice dude. He obviously, when young athletes tend to have families that tend to settle them down a little bit, obviously Lonzo has a daughter similar to even Jason Tatum's the same way. It tends to settle them down a little bit where they can kind of adapt quicker. And that's what's happened with Lonzo Ball. He's always had a level head on his shoulders, as opposed to what some people have been saying. There's a very clear contrast between him and his father in that case. He's come out as a leader. He's become a leader in the locker room. He's become one of the voices of the New Orleans Pelicans, along with Zion Williamson. And, I couldn't be happy for him. I think he's playing great, and I hope his run continues. I think at this trajectory, the Pelicans, I think they should make the play-in games at least, if not the playoffs. And I think maybe next year will be the season where they can move into becoming a top six, top five, top four seed. When they have an all-star like Zion already, and they have a small forward who's an all-star last year, Brandon Ingram, who's just an excellent player. And they have Lonzo Ball, and they have Josh Hart, and they have Steven Adams and Eric Bledsoe. They have these young talent, and they have a couple of veterans as well on the roster, J.J. Redick as well, to complement the young players. And Stan Van Gundy is a great coach who's really coached up Zion to play well. And that brings me to my next point, Zion Williamson. Again, come back to the point of hype. In 17 years, no player had been hyped as much as Zion Williamson had been hyped. The last player to have the kind of hype that Zion Williamson did coming into the NBA was probably LeBron James. That's the kind of expectation that the NBA community and basketball fans all over the world have for Zion Williamson. It's pretty crazy to put that kind of expectation on the shoulders of a then 18, 19-year-old. This kid has to come in to a franchise that just lost its star in Anthony Davis, has this stockpile of young, really good young thoroughbreds, young players, and just flip the switch, change the team. And that's exactly what he's done. Last year, obviously, he was out for a majority of the season. Sorry, he was out for a majority of the season with an injury. I believe his knees, I believe they were trying to work out how they could adapt his body type to becoming an NBA player, because playing in NBA is very different from playing in college. In college, you only play about 35 to 40 games at most. In the NBA, you play 82 games plus playoffs. The season's obviously only about 65 to 70 games, but still, you get my point. They were trying to learn how to, I guess, adjust his body type to becoming a so that he could be a durable player in the NBA. And this season, with the new coach, Alvin Gentry was, of course, let go, even though Zion looked really, really impressive at the end of last season. Until the bubble, of course, I think things kind of started to fall apart for the Pelicans at the bubble with Alvin Gentry, so they had to fire him, and then they brought in Stan Van Gundy, who took the Orlando Magic. I mean, come on. He took the Orlando Magic to the finals in 2000 and, I believe it was 2009. Yeah, he took the Magic to the finals in 2009 with Dwight Howard. And Zion isn't Dwight Howard, but he's same in the sense that he's a physical specimen. The guy has a 40-inch vertical. He's 6'6", 285 pounds. I mean, the guy, he's built like an absolute bulldozer. The guy is insane. He's so strong, so fast. So he has a quick tip. He has this quick twitch as well. And he moves players around. Like, you watch yesterday's game between the Jazz and the Pelicans, like, Rudy Gobert is one of the two best defensive players in the NBA. And he could not handle Zion. He was getting pushed around by Zion. He was getting bullied by Zion on the block. And Rudy Gobert is on, he's in the middle of a 5-year, $200 million contract. One of the best defensive players in the NBA. He's won the Defensive Player of the Year award. Just an excellent player overall on the defensive side of the ball. And he was getting absolutely bullied by Zion, both on the boards and in the post. Zion, first of all, is a physical specimen. That quick twitch, speed, strength, change of direction, vertical, athleticism, everything. He's a complete package. And now he stayed healthy for the majority of the season, and he's an all-star this season, which is amazing. And he completely deserved to be. Like, no one's going to argue that he didn't. I think he's averaging like 24, 10 and 5, something like that. Some really, really good stat line. And he absolutely deserved to be an all-star. He's the leader of this team at just 20 years old. Again, just like Lonzo Ball, such a level head on his shoulders. So sensible. Never really took the hype too seriously. Never let it go to his head. He's always been this really quiet, unassuming guy. Sorry, yeah, not like 25.5 points a game, 7 rebounds a game, 3 assists on, what is it, 61% field goal percentage. I mean, that is, whoa, that is crazy. I mean, that is insane. You run out of words for this guy sometimes. And I think a lot of credit has to go to Stan Van Gundy. He decided to put the ball in Zion's hands on the perimeter, allow him to drive in, allow him to kind of initiate plays, while also contributing in pick and roll situations and running the floor, with obviously the lob threat that he is with Lonzo when Lonzo has the ball in his hands. And also, he's really evolved as a passer. Like, I remember a pass he makes yesterday, pass he made yesterday. I mean, it was insane. It was like he was going to make an up and under. He was surrounded by three defenders, and he somehow spots JJ Redick, who's wide open at the 3-point line. I don't know how he saw him, and puts the ball around the defender in the post and passes to JJ Redick in the wing, who hits the easy three. You run out of words. You really, really, really do. He's spectacular. He's amazing. He's insane. He's a specimen. He's just everything that you want him to be. And he's beginning to live up to the hype, that potential that we all saw when he was playing in South Carolina in high school, when he was playing at Duke, just dominating NCAA basketball. I mean, just absolutely dominating NCAA basketball. And he deserves all the credit in the world. He's improving as a defensive player as well. He has the stature for it, obviously. But now he's developing the IQ as well to play defense in the NBA. Obviously, he has a very good basketball IQ, which, sometimes players with insane athleticism rely on that athleticism too much. And sometimes they don't take film study as seriously. They don't take tactical work as seriously. But you see players like Zion, like LeBron James, like, I mean, even like Lonzo Ball, for example. He's 6'6". He's a very tall point guard. These players, they take the film study seriously, and that's what puts them on another level. And that's where I think Lonzo's going to go to that level. I think Zion's already at that level. I think he's only going to keep improving. He's become a top 10, top 15 player in the NBA by the end of the season. And then next season, take that jump to become an MVP level player and guide the Pelicans to a top 4 seed in the playoffs to become an actual contender. Maybe not win, because it's still only his third season, but become a contender for sure. And I think he's well on his way. And the third NBA player I wanted to talk about, as I said before, was LaMelo Ball. I mean, this kid, we've seen LaMelo Ball since he was 13 years old. We've seen him drop 92 points in a game in high school. We've seen him play in Lithuania, Australia, IMG Academy, in his dad's league, drop out of high school at 16. He's done it all. Like, the guy's done it all. He's had an experience as a teenager that probably no basketball player ever has had. The kind of international exposure that he's had. And there were a lot of doubts regarding his maturity. Like, again, the Facebook show, you saw him staying up at night, playing video games a lot, not maintaining a proper diet, not being as committed to the game as he should have been, maybe sometimes. I don't know. But you've seen over the last year and a half, couple of years, he's started to take the game really seriously. He's, put those distractions to the side, like Big Baller Brand, this, that, and the other, all the controversy regarding, what happened with that whole situation. He's put that all to the side, focused on his game. Like, I think his dad was talking about this. His coach at IMG Academy was kind of his biggest influence. When he came back to play and finish his high school career in the United States after playing in Lithuania and playing in his dad's league, I believe he got an exemption of some sort. He couldn't go and play in college, but he could finish playing in high school. And you saw that kind of dedication that he showed to his craft. And again, he's a generational talent. Like, the Ball brothers are different. LaMelo Ball is different from even from Lonzo Ball. He can shoot. He can play make. He's a 6'8" point guard. He's got, I mean, he's an opportunistic defender. He's been playing okay defense. I think there's a long way to go for him to become a good defender. But he's an opportunistic defender, and he tries to play defense. He isn't that kind of cherry picking player that we saw, in high school. I use Kemba Walker as an example. Kemba Walker does not have the physical stature to play defense. He's barely 6 foot and not even 200 pounds, but he tries to play defense. He doesn't make much of an impact, but at least he tries. He makes a little bit, a very slight impact, and even that helps the Celtics. I think LaMelo Ball has the physical stature, and he's trying as well. And I think as time goes by, he will become a better defender. But on the offensive side of the ball, this kid is insane. This kid has it all. His passing ability, his ball handle is amazing, like way far superior to Lonzo's. He's got a really clean ball handle. He's a really good finisher at the rim. He can shoot. He can, take contact. And he has the respect of players around the league. Like you saw yesterday, Carmelo Anthony, just like respect, show so much respect to LaMelo Ball because he respects what he can do. The kid, I see the kid, he's older than me, but I'm still going to say the kid. The kid has got insane potential. He's playing so well. I think since becoming a starter, he's averaging like 20 points, 7 rebounds, 7 assists, some insane stat line like that. He's definitely winning Rookie of the Year at this point in time, especially. All credit goes to LeVar, to Lonzo, to his mother, Tina Ball, to his coach at IMG, to his coaches in Australia, and most of all, obviously James Borrego finally put him in to start after leaving him on the bench for such a long time, which I didn't think was justified, but at least he finally put him in the starting lineup a few weeks ago. I believe it was something like a month ago. Michael Jordan, obviously, for drafting him. Finally, Michael Jordan making a good pick, it looks like. And especially his coach at IMG Academy, I think, almost changed the trajectory of his career. And most of all, LaMelo himself, because he showed that dedication, that willingness to work, to change his diet, to change his play style, to become more selfless, to showcase his superior playmaking skills by developing his basketball IQ, by watching tape. And you can't do anything but respect that. That's a product of his work. Nobody can make him do that if he doesn't want to do it himself. And he wanted to do it himself, and he did it. So all the credit in the world goes to LaMelo Ball. Now, one last NBA thing to discuss. And I talked about this on Origins Podcast. Again, it's called Turnaround Tuesdays. Go check it out. Apple Podcasts. He brings on different guests every week. It's a great podcast. Go and have a listen. And we were talking about the Minnesota Timberwolves and how this kind of dodgy process they undertook in firing Ryan Saunders after coaching a game one night. And then the same night, somehow having an agreement in place to sign a Raptors assistant coach who isn't even the top Raptors assistant. Chris Finch is the Raptors' number three. Nick Nurse is the number one. The number two is Adrian Griffin, who's, I guess, just so happens to be a black guy and wasn't prioritized by the Minnesota Timberwolves in his hiring. And for some reason, they go to the number three guy while having the coach who coached up Dame Lillard and CJ McCollum to become one of the best backcourts in the NBA, as their assistant head coach David Vanterpool is already in Minnesota at the beginning of the season as their assistant head coach, and he's kind of shepherded Damian Lillard into becoming one of the best point guards in the NBA. The best point guard, in my opinion. I think I've made my feelings on Dame Lillard very, very clear. And CJ McCollum become an excellent, excellent player. And for some reason, he doesn't get the job, even though he's already in the organization. And then there are so many other options. Again, Adrian Griffin in Toronto, who's Nick Nurse's actual assistant, who actually contributed in a major way to them winning a championship and being a consistent team and making the playoffs last year. You think about the assistant coaches in LA, Phil Handy, Mike Brown. I don't think Mike Brown's in LA, but Mike Brown did coach LeBron James and the Cavs in his first round when they made the finals for the first time. Coached the Warriors with KD when Steve goes out with an injury. Obviously has a really good track record as a coach. But even if you don't want to retread like Mike Brown, fine. Look at the other options. Phil Handy, Lionel Hollins, David Vanterpool, Adrian Griffin. And for some reason, you go with Chris Finch. Now, firstly, the legality and the ethicality of it is questionable. Because there is no way you took permission from the Toronto Raptors, agreed to a contract with Chris Finch, and were able to announce it a few hours, do all of that in a few hours after you fire Ryan Saunders. What that tells me is that contact had already been established. While they had someone who was employed in the same position, they were looking for other people to fill up that guy's position without terminating his contract. Now, the ethicality and legality of it can definitely be debated. But when you talk about the hiring of minority coaches in the NBA, in the NFL, this is the problem. They're clearly more qualified. Everyone thinks it's an affirmative action thing. No, it isn't. Look at they're qualified. Eric Bieniemy doesn't have a job. And Nick Sirianni, who the hell is Nick Sirianni? Why does Nick Sirianni have a job in the NFL as a head coach? You're telling me that guy who started through his entire press conference in front of the city of Philadelphia, who want a strong coach at the helm, who want a coach who can command his players, who can build a culture, they hired that guy who could barely string five words together without stuttering. I mean, come on. And I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I'm not accusing anyone of racism or anything like that. I'm just saying, this has to be a thing that should be looked at. There is some unconscious bias present in the minds of these owners, and I don't know where it comes from, but it comes from some stereotype that they're imagining about coaches of minority race. There are what, three? I think there are like four or five coaches in the NFL who are minorities. Ron Rivera, and look at the coaches who are minorities. Mike Tomlin, who has never had a losing record in the 16 years or 15 years he's been the head coach of the Steelers, or 14, I think. Never had a losing record. He had Duck Hodges playing quarterback for him last year, and he still went 8-8. And then you have Brian Flores, who's seen as one. He was a coach of the year candidate this year in his second year as coach. The only one that I like, Dave Culley. Dave Culley had to serve like 30 years as an assistant head coach, as an assistant in the NFL before becoming a head coach. Ron Rivera is one of the most successful coaches in the NBA. Who's one of the best culture builders in the NBA. Just made the playoffs with the freaking Washington Redskins. The old Washington Redskins, my bad. Again, they were called by such a racist name. And he came in after they changed their name and built a new culture. And they made the playoffs. They made the playoffs. And then, you know, it's really shocking. And then look at NFL history. You look at Tom Flores. You know, two-time Super Bowl winner with the Raiders. You look at all of these minority coaches who have contributed so much to the NFL. Obviously, the situation is better in the NBA. You have more minority coaches. You have Monty Williams, who, again, one of the best coaches in the NBA. Sons of the four seed. Before he came in, they were the bottom feeders of the Western Conference, perennially. Then you look at other coaches like Tyronn Lue, NBA Finals champion. There are a lot of great black coaches, great James Borrego even in Charlotte. There are a lot of great black coaches and minority coaches in the NBA. But there is a system that does stop more qualified coaches from getting a job, or qualified coaches from getting a job. And it's really shocking to me, and I do think that it needs to be looked at. Because what you're doing, like, the owners need to understand, at the end of the day, the only people that they're affecting in a major way is themselves. Not anyone else. It's themselves. Because they're excluding a major portion of the talent pool who are extremely qualified to fulfill a job, who have job experience, who have great resumes, who have served as assistants for so long, who have developed great players, but somehow they continue to ignore them. They continue to do it. And again, this is why the Minnesota Timberwolves are one of the worst organizations in the NBA. They've sucked for so long, they're going to continue to suck. They've had, what, 3 number one draft picks in the last, last decade or something like that. And they keep sucking. The only time they were ever good, they had Jimmy Butler on their team for a year. And even Jimmy Butler wanted to leave because the team was so toxic and lazy. It had lacked work ethic. And there's a reason that the Minnesota Timberwolves are the bottom feeders of the NBA, have the worst record in the NBA, despite having players like Karl Anthony Towns, D'Angelo Russell, and Anthony Edwards. I'm scared for Anthony Edwards. He's a great player. Like, that dunk that we saw, that might have been one of the best dunks we've seen in a long, long time. And that's just one part of his game. He's a great scorer. He's a good defender. He has size, speed, good ball handler, good playmaker. But his career is going to be wasted with the Timberwolves. And I'm scared of that. I don't want talent like that to be wasted. Trade him somewhere else. Just sell the team. Just sell the team. Like, if an organization is bad, what they need to do is just sell the team. They're not benefiting anyone. They'll be able to make money by selling the team. I think the same thing about the Detroit Lions, who made Barry Sanders and Calvin Johnson pay them money back after they forced them to retire because they overworked those players. They underpaid those players. They didn't put any, they didn't put talent around those players. Maybe not underpaid, but they didn't put any good talent around those players. And then they retired, and then the Lions asked for their money back. You look at that in contrast with, say, the Indianapolis Colts, well-run organization, great GM, Chris Ballard, good owner, Jim Irsay, Andrew Luck retires because of injury. What do the Colts do? As a measure of goodwill, thanking him for the service, they let him keep the money for the final year of his contract. That's what good organizations do, man. I'm not saying just throw away your money. I'm saying have some kind of culture, respect the past, respect the players that have come through. You hear from Kevin Garnett how much he hates the Timberwolves. Kevin Garnett is the greatest player in the history of the Timberwolves. And there is no close second. Everyone else is irrelevant. Maybe Kevin Love was really good for a point in time. But Kevin Garnett is by so far the greatest player in Timberwolves history. And he hates the organization. He hates them. He hates the owner. He doesn't want his jersey to be retired by the Timberwolves. If the Timberwolves had to retire one jersey, it would be Kevin Garnett's. And he doesn't want that jersey to be retired because the Timberwolves are trash. They are the trash of the NBA. They're the bottom feeders of the NBA. And unless they change quickly, they're going to continue to be so. Along with the Detroit Lions in the NFL, they're just the same. And if they don't change quickly, it's going to be more trouble for them. It's not going to affect me. I'm a Packers fan. I'm a Celtics fan. My teams are good organizations. They're run well. They're consistently good. The Celtics might not be great this season, but they have 2 young stars. The Packers, like, I was pissed at the Jordan Love pick last year, but now that I think back upon it, it makes sense. Who knew? I believed in Aaron Rodgers, but they had, I guess, some form of empirical evidence not to believe in Aaron Rodgers. So they decided to draft a backup, let him sit for a couple of years, and then become the next great quarterback for the Packers, continue that tradition. Of course, there are questions about Jordan Love. Of course, that pick might be the reason why we didn't make the Super Bowl. Maybe if we drafted an interior lineman, a cornerback, a linebacker, a wide receiver, we might have been in the Super Bowl. We might have won the Super Bowl. But if you look at the long term, we draft well. We develop well. The Celtics draft well, develop well. They're a bit more passive, but that's okay. Because they're always consistent. They're always good. You'd rather be good for 20 seasons than win one Super Bowl and be trash for 19 seasons. Things need to change. These organizations need to be held accountable, and if they're not, it's going to be the fault of their fans and their organization, not anyone else. Sorry, I might have got a little carried away and emotional there, but this is something that I'm really passionate about, because being an owner of a team is a dream. And someone has achieved that dream and they're willing to throw it all away. So I get angered by that. Like, I don't understand why it happens. Okay. Let's move on. Now, NFL. So, JJ Watt comes out. I mean, just an amazing, amazing Instagram post. It was really funny. Source me. Picture of him squatting. on the squad rack with an Arizona Cardinals t-shirt. I mean, he looks great. He looks in great shape, as he always has. One of the best defensive players ever. He's going to be. He was a Hall of Famer 5 years ago. Forget now. He was a Hall of Famer 5 years ago. 5 years in, he played 5 years in the league and he was already a Hall of Famer. Because by the time he played 5 years in the league, he was a three-time Defensive Player of the Year. Three-time. And I mean, I'm not sure, but there are less than five people who have ever done that. And ever since then, he's only built upon his legacy. I mean, he has been injured for a couple of seasons, but he had 18 sacks a couple of years ago. He's always been a really great pass rusher and run stopper. And the Arizona, now, look, I'm disappointed that the Packers didn't get him, but at that price, I don't think the Packers should have gotten him, should have tried to get him. I mean, $15.5 million a year contract is pretty crazy. The Packers can't afford him. But even the Cardinals are kind of, I mean, they're not cash strapped. They're not, they don't have a ton of cap space. I thought maybe a team like, I thought Cleveland was probably the most likely destination because they do have cap space. They don't look like they're going to be extending Baker Mayfield for a huge contract. So I thought that would be the most logical destination, but it didn't happen. But the Cardinals, now you look at their defense. And the stats been doing the rounds on Twitter, on Instagram, on all these big TV shows, sports shows. The top two sack getters of the last 9 years, since 2012, are Chandler Jones, number one, and J.J. Watt, number two. And now they get to play on the same defensive line. The last time Chandler Jones was healthy, he had 20 sacks. 20, I believe. I'm not 100% sure, but I do think it was something close to that. He's an excellent sack creator. The guy is, I mean, he's a nightmare. He played for the New England Patriots. He played for the Cardinals, and obviously, you see, like it's like his whole family, like is just genetically, I believe they're just built to be superior athletes. Like you think about John Jones, who's probably the greatest UFC fighter of all time. He's Chandler Jones' brother, so it's like that. He has those genetics in him, to be a great athlete. And yeah, he did have 19 sacks the last time we saw him healthy. That was in the 2019 season. He was injured one game into the last season, which I believe is a big reason why the Cardinals didn't make the playoffs, only finished 8-8. And look, the Cardinals are in an interesting spot. The Cardinals, sorry, they're in an interesting spot because. Look, they have Kyler Murray, who's shown some like special things. But he also got injured at the end of last season. He's a small quarterback, 5'10", extremely athletic, great arm. He has a big arm, quite accurate with delivering the football. DeAndre Hopkins, great receiver. They have Christian Kirk. They have an okay offensive line. They need to draft linemen. In the first, they need to draft an offensive lineman in the first couple of rounds in the draft this year. In order to protect Kyler, because look, Kyler's in a unique situation. He's 5'10". He's the shortest quarterback in the NFL, and he needs to be protected. Because if he isn't protected, he's not like one of those strong quarterbacks. Like say, Russell Wilson is a strong quarterback. He's big. Even though he's only 6 foot, he's like 5'10". Again, he's not even 6 foot. He's like 5'10", 5'11". He's big. Kyler Murray is very slight. Him and Lamar Jackson are very slight. Lamar Jackson is obviously quite tall, but coming back to Kyler Murray, he's very slight. He's not big. So he needs to be protected because when your quarterback is slight, there's a higher chance of them getting injured as well, isn't there? So I think the offense is good. Cliff Kingsbury, I have my doubts about him as a head coach. And I just want to talk about this for a bit. Sorry to get a bit sidetracked, but there's a big misconception in the NFL about what a head coach is supposed to be. A head coach isn't supposed to be the guy who's calling plays on the offensive or defensive side of the ball. A head coach is supposed to be a guy who is much like us, who's watching the game from a much, much, much closer and analytical perspective and understanding what's going to go on the offensive side of the ball next, what's going to go on the defensive side of the ball next, being able to prepare over the week for both sides of the ball and special teams as well. Special teams are so undervalued in the NFL, I can't tell you. I'll probably do a bit on that in the coming weeks because it's quite shocking to me because special teams are so important and it's so undervalued. So, yeah, once again, getting back to head coaches, they need to be involved on both sides of the ball and on special teams and in crafting and overall game plan and setting a culture in the organization. Their job is just to call plays. And I love Matt LaFleur, but I don't think he was a great head coach in the last couple of years. I think this year he's going to be a great head coach. Even though he won 26 games, I think this year he's going to be a great head coach because he said he's going to be more involved in special teams on both sides of the ball. And that's what I want to see from a head coach. That's your job. You're not a coordinator anymore. You're a head coach. And the same thing goes for Cliff Kingsbury. I have my doubts about him because he does not get involved in the defensive side of the ball. Now, Vance Joseph, who is the Cardinals' defensive coordinator, is a very good defensive coach. But even then, it's your head coach is the one who's running the organization. It's his job to impose his values, his mentality, and his thoughts onto the team in every phase of the game. And that's what I believe Cliff Kingsbury is lacking. I don't know whether he's going to be able to put that into action. Let's see. But, you know, the Cardinals have always been a very ambitious organization. You know, they've not been afraid to sign veterans. Like, they signed Kurt Warner in 2007 to back up Matt Leinart. And then Kurt Warner took over and led them to a Super Bowl, which is crazy. And then, obviously, played one of the greatest playoff games of all time against Aaron Rodgers and the Packers in Rodgers' first playoff game. So, you've seen the Cardinals. They're not afraid to do things. Steve Keim is a very good is a very good general manager. They had Bruce Arians as their coach. That same adventurous mindset, aggressive mindset, still remains in the organization that Bruce Arians has taken to Tampa Bay and won a Super Bowl with. So, you know, I think the offensive side of the ball has a lot of pieces. They need to develop their offensive line, and I think they could be really good if they manage to protect Kyler, because Kyler's, again, generational talent. The athleticism, the arm, like, forget the height. The athleticism, the arm, the accuracy. I mean, he's a quiet guy. He's not your stereotypical leader, but he seems to have, again, a very level head on his shoulders, very calm. He's good under pressure. You remember the Cardinals Seahawks game, I think it was week 6 or week 7. I think it was week 7. It was a night game. It was one of the best games of the NFL this season. It was an amazing game, overtime game. I love watching it. Very level head on Kylo's shoulders. He did a great job that game, played really well. So I think he's definitely a future MVP candidate. I think he will be in the running this season, but not in the top 5. Maybe top 10 for sure, is what I believe. So that's the offensive side of the ball. But when you look at the defensive side of the ball, now you have J.J. Watt and Chandler Jones coming off opposite edges on the defensive line. Those are definitely scary hours. Then you have Jordan Phillips, a D-tackle, who's a very good D-tackle. You have Patrick Peterson, a cornerback, one of the best cornerbacks of our generation. Obviously, he's getting older right now, but he's still really good. Buda Baker, one of the best safeties in the game. Probably, let's be honest, probably the best safety in the game. Everyone remembers him for the DK Metcalf rundown play, but he's a great player. So, you know, I think the Cardinals are in an interesting spot because they're in the best division in the NFL. You could make an argument. Actually, it's pretty easy to make an argument that all four teams in the NFC West, San Francisco, Seattle, Arizona, Los Angeles Rams, all should be in the playoffs next year. So, if they're all healthy, they're all playoff teams, which is, I mean, all four teams making the playoffs can happen. It's unprecedented, but it can happen. Let's see if it does, because now you're in a great division. The only person I really do feel bad for is Russell Wilson, who seems to be on the way out. I mean, I'm not sure, but the more and more you hear about it, it seems like he's on his way out. I don't think he's going to leave, but like all these reports are saying that he is. I'll get into that next week probably about Russell Wilson. Let's see if anything's happened by then. But Seattle needs to draft an offensive, like just redo their offensive line. They have a good left tackle in Dwayne Brown. They have, I think they, dra- I believe they drafted a guard, I believe, who played really well. If I'm forgetting his name right now, but Seattle, I think they have they need to improve their offensive line. If they do, they'll be in the running again to win the NFC West and get to the NFC Championship game, maybe the Super Bowl. I think there are two teams better than all the teams in the NFC West, the Packers and the Bucks. But let's see. You know, you never know what's going to happen. It's too early to make any of those predictions yet, but all four teams in the NFC West do look scary. That's what I can tell you. And if I had to pick one team that was the worst in that division right now, I'd pick Seattle probably. Like, I mean, Los Angeles have I think the 49ers and the Rams are clear 1 and 2. I think the Cardinals are number 3 right now. If you look at the totality of that team, great receivers, Seattle also has great receivers. The up-and-coming quarterback, really, like the closest approximation to Russell Wilson is Kyler Murray. So, you know, let's see. It's going to be very, very interesting in the NFC West. Now, I said I did want to talk about some free agency quarterbacks who I thought were in some really interesting positions. Now, look, there's been some news about Alex Smith getting released by Washington. He's probably going to get released by Washington. And I just want to say, I mean, what a story. I mean, just incredible. The fact that he came back from that injury, that gruesome, gruesome, gruesome injury, the way that he did. And what he went 5-1 as starter. I mean, that, look, I don't believe in quarterback win-loss records, but in the 6 games he played, he started, Washington won 5. And there is something to be said for the influence that kind of leader, that kind of inspiration can have on your team. People credit Tom Brady with that as well, but they don't credit any other quarterback with it. And I think you do need to take that into account. That is what I believe, that Alex Smith doing that had an influence on Washington's defense, on Washington's offense. When you have a leader, the quarterback is the leader of the team. Let's be honest. In most teams, the quarterback is the leader of the team because he is the most important player on the team. And Alex Smith came back from so much. I mean, he talked about he might have lost his life. He had septic. His right leg was septic. He had sepsis on his right leg, and after having, you know, all those surgeries, he almost lost his life. You know, he was knocked out for like 4 or 5 weeks. He says he went for like several months without knowing what is happening because he was unconscious for so long. And just to see him come back is insane. And I think Alex Smith could definitely contribute to the team. I think Alex Smith should go down to Jacksonville. Look, I think he still has the ability to be a starting quarterback. And I think that's what Jacksonville should do. Jacksonville are going to draft Trevor Lawrence with the number one pick. They're a team that is rebuilding in a major way. And I think there is a danger to putting in your quarterback too early. Trevor Lawrence, I think, even though he is that generational talent that we all see, again, I think I'm using the word generational talent too much, but still, he is the generational talent that we all see. He's a great, great player. Size, speed, strength, arm strength, accuracy, arm talent. Like, it's a combination that we haven't seen since maybe Andrew Luck came out. And again, Andrew Luck is the closest comparison for Trevor Lawrence because Andrew Luck didn't have the opportunity to sit behind a Peyton Manning, to sit behind a great quarterback for some years. And that affected him in the long run because he got hit so much because his team's offensive line wasn't good. And I think the same thing could happen to Trevor Lawrence. I hope it doesn't, but I do think they need to have Alex Smith in there. Either as a starter for a few weeks, you know, while the team settles and the offensive line gets settled. Alex Smith knows how not to get hit because that's what he was doing in Washington this year. The offense could be designed in that particular way to avoid Alex Smith from getting hit. But I think even as a backup, he has a lot to contribute because, again, like you heard Mahomes and Kelce talking about the kind of impact Alex Smith had on Mahomes. And Mahomes is a top two quarterback in the NFL right now. And he's going to be one of the greatest to ever do it by the time he's done, for sure. The best to ever do it, almost undoubtedly, unless there's some major fall-off occurs. And I don't think there will be, but in case. God forbid. But, again, I think Alex Smith should go down to Jacksonville, have the opportunity to mentor Trevor Lawrence. And I think he's the kind of guy, he said he doesn't want to coach, but I think he's the kind of guy that I could definitely see becoming an OC and a head coach. So that could be kind of his foray into it. He's getting old, 36, 37. He's had that really bad injury. But if he does want to play, there are some opportunities for places he could go and play. New England, for example. New England's looking for a quarterback. They had Tom Brady. Tom Brady is a very underrated, talented quarterback. He has very good arm, very accurate, he's very smart. Like, his ability to read the defense and read the field is uncanny. I haven't seen many who can do it the way Tom Brady can. And I think Alex Smith is in a similar mold. He doesn't have the arm strength that Tom Brady has, or, you know, I laugh when I say it's the athletic ability, because Tom Brady is, he's not fast, and he's very slow, in fact. But his athletic ability is different because of the way he's been able to play for so long and his arm strength and all of that. He could put real zip on the ball even last year. Alex Smith might not be able to do that, but he will be able to manage a game. he will be able to call a good run game, get the ball out to receivers and running backs quickly. You know, just the kind of thing that Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels like. So I think if he wants to play, I think New England is a very viable destination. I think New England drafts a quarterback in the draft this year, and I think they let him sit behind Alex Smith for a year. They have a really good offensive line. So while the quarterback develops and learns how to read defenses, there's a lot of scope for improvement there. Now, I think the next really interesting quarterback is Marcus Mariota. Now, Marcus Mariota was drafted by, who was it? Yeah, the Tennessee Titans with the second pick of the 2015 draft. Really good arm strength, very good arm talent. One of the best college quarterbacks ever at Oregon. And just athletically very, very gifted. And he underwhelmed for sure in his time with the Titans. But you could see the problem with the Titans, they were so reliant upon Marcus Mariota. You put Mariota in the current offense with Derrick Henry, and I think he'd flourish. I think he'd be a great quarterback. Maybe, I think Ryan Tannehill, again, so underrated. I don't think he'd be as good as Ryan Tannehill. But you don't have to be as good as Ryan Tannehill. Ryan Tannehill is a top 10 quarterback for sure. I think Mariota could definitely be a top 15 quarterback in the NFL this season if he gets the chance to start. And I think he should go to Washington. I talked about this earlier. Washington doesn't have a quarterback. They need that quarterback who can flourish. They have a great defense. They have a really good run game. They have a good offensive line. Decent set of weapons. I think they go out and draft a weapon in the first round this year, probably a receiver. And I think Marcus Mariota could fit in seamlessly. And that team could, with Mariota, I think they'd win the division. Because they have the best defense by far. And with Mariota, they'd have a good offense and a good quarterback who could make the offense more varied, you know. The quarterback run game could be evolved. And I think he's the perfect fit there. And the third quarterback I want to talk about is Cam Newton. I think Dak, okay, I think quickly, let me just say, I think Dak Prescott is going to stay with the Cowboys. I think eventually they get that deal done. I hope they do, because if they don't, that would be a travesty for the Cowboys. That would just be one of the dumbest moves of Jerry Jones' career. I think he should just retire on the spot if Dak Prescott leaves. But once again, coming back to Cam Newton. Now, I talked about Cam last week, where he's interesting in the sense that he played great at the beginning of the season. Against Miami, first game of the season, 75 rushing yards, 2 touchdowns, great. Again, running the ball, he was really good throughout the season. Then you look at, you know, Seattle, like 400 passing yards. I mean, he was incredible. Against the Raiders, he was great. Cam Newton is still a really, really good quarterback. And he had COVID last year, and that kind of derailed things. He had to learn like a new offense in like a month with the Patriots. Remember, he wasn't signed in like, you know, in OTAs. He wasn't allowed to go through that entire process and Zoom calls and meetings with Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels. He was kind of thrust into the role of starting quarterback. Did have an opportunity to learn such an intricate system so quickly. And I think Cam Newton still has a lot to offer. I think he needs to rehab his shoulder, because his throwing motion did look kind of wacky at points. But I think if he does do that over the next few months, I think he definitely has an opportunity to come back as a really good starting quarterback. I'm not sure where he goes. I'm thinking, again, Washington's an option if they don't get Marcus Mariota. I'm thinking he could even go back to New England. I think Houston, if they do let go of Deshaun Watson, they might get Teddy Bridgewater. But I do think Teddy Bridgewater will end up being caught and picked up by someone else or traded. Because there was some rumors that San Francisco is also interested in Teddy Bridgewater. But they don't have the cap space for him. But I think the Texans would be a decent destination for Cam. I think he needs to go to a place with this good offensive line, though, and the Texans don't necessarily have that. I think Chicago is definitely definitely an option for Cam, because, again, mobile quarterback. They need to improve their offensive line there, but they do have some weapons. They need to re-sign Allen Robinson. I don't know what they're doing with Allen Robinson. I mean, it doesn't make any sense what the Bears are doing. So I think they have an okay offensive line, which they need to improve. A really good defense, some weapons, Darnell Mooney, David Montgomery. And, you know, I think they'll definitely pick up a couple of receivers in free agency who will be able to contribute, even if they don't draft a receiver in the first round. So I think those are three spots that Cam Newton can go. And now, just to conclude, as I said before, and someone actually asked me the question, who I think the most underrated quarterback in the NFL is. It got me thinking. So I think I can answer the question with two names. First one is Derek Carr. I think Derek Carr is really, really, really underrated. I think he's Derek Carr went 12-4 in 2016 and was an MVP candidate before he broke his leg. Broke his leg, not even like dislocated something, but his leg broke. And the Raiders obviously lost in the first round of the playoffs to the Texans because they didn't have Derek Carr. And since then, Derek Carr has been criticized so much. And that in large part due to John Gruden's unwillingness to commit to him. And John Gruden is one of the most overrated head coaches that we've seen. I think he's a decent, he's a very good offensive mind, but as a head coach, he's so overrated. The one time that he did win a Super Bowl with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, he won with a great defense that he had no role in controlling. And his offense was barely average, maybe slightly above average, nothing more. And John Gruden just isn't a great head coach. And even he, and he's not willing to endorse Derek Carr. Derek Carr deserves to go somewhere where he's going to be endorsed as the starting quarterback. He deserves to be endorsed as a starting quarterback. He is a very, very good quarterback. And for some people, for some reason, people continue to underrate him. He's really good. He's accurate. He can throw a deep ball. He's mobile. He can move around in the pocket, step up in the pocket, go outside of the pocket. He's a good leader. He calls a great run game. He's very intelligent, great football IQ. He can read the field. He can call an audible. He can do everything. And he's a top 10 quarterback. He's for sure a top 10 quarterback. Derek Carr's a top 10 quarterback. I don't care what anyone tells me. He's really, really good. And the second quarterback that came to mind was Ryan Tannehill. I've talked about both these quarterbacks today. But again, Ryan Tannehill was stuck under the horrors and the just horrible leadership of Adam Gase for so long. It contaminated him. It does. Things like that happen. His ability to play quarterback in the NFL was contaminated by Adam Gase, who was the one of the worst head coaches I have ever seen. One of the worst offensive, oh, forget head coaches, one of the worst offensive coordinators I've ever seen. The guy is has been hired because he helped the he coordinated. I think he coordinated for Peyton Manning. But when you coordinate for Peyton Manning, you're not really doing anything, especially in the last part of his career. Peyton Manning had the playbook. He ran that offense. He did everything. And because he endorsed Adam Gase, this guy who would, kneel down to him and let him run the offense, Miami felt the need to hire him. And the Jets felt the need to hire him. Again, two organizations that were really bad but are now, on the uprise, I'd say. And because of that, Ryan Tannehill was contaminated. But now you look at him after he came, after he got under the virus that is Adam Gase, and went to Tennessee, played as a backup to Mariota at the beginning, came in I think week 6 to week 7, absolutely balled out the rest of the season. I think had a passer rating of something like 118, 22 touchdowns, 6 picks. He was great last season. He was so good, and this season his level of play just went up again. He was excellent. He's one of the top 7 or 8 quarterbacks in the NFL, and he played like it. And obviously, a lot of his success is reliant upon Derrick Henry. That's for sure. I'm not denying that. But still, you need to have the ability to do that. If you don't do that, you don't deserve to be in the NFL, and you don't deserve to play for the team. And Ryan Tannehill's playing at such a high level. He was early in the season when the Titans were 5-0. He was an MVP candidate. He threw 33 touchdowns and 7 picks. He played great. He played really, really well this season. Again, he's not someone that people talk about. Obviously, he did receive a deal for, I think it was 4 years, $120 million. Completely deserved it, what he got at the end of last season. I think Mike Vrabel and the Titans and Derrick Henry and A.J. Brown and, that entire team is only going to continue to get better as time progresses. Ryan Tannehill isn't that old. I think he's 31 right now, so 32. So he has another 3 to 4 years to play at this peak. Because he's also very athletically gifted. Don't forget, he played wide receiver in college. And then he transitioned to playing quarterback. So he's really athletically gifted, and you saw that. He took a read option play for a touchdown, 55-yard touchdown against the Packers. Great secondary, outran all of them and took it for a touchdown. It's a play that I remember, but I think it's a play that all of you should look up. Pretty entertaining to watch. So those are the two most underrated quarterbacks in the NFL right now, in my opinion. I think Tom Brady is very underrated. It's tough to underrate the GOAT. But even as a quarterback, he's very underrated. He's a very, very good quarterback. Lamar Jackson also gets a lot of hate that he doesn't deserve. I love Lamar Jackson. I think he's going to elevate again and take the Ravens back to where they need to be. And let me just conclude by saying these three words: pay Lamar Jackson. The Ravens, you need to pay Lamar Jackson. Thank you so much for listening to the rundown. I'll see you next week. I'm Dheeraj Devarajan. This has been a blast. Goodbye.